Good evening. Trump guts the Environmental Protection Act. The future of the post office in doubt. 75 years since becoming death, the destroyer of worlds, and a fight with police supporters on the Brooklyn Bridge. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Thursday, July 16th, 2020. The Supreme Court let stand a lower court ruling that would strip voting eligibility from up to 1 million Florida felons who have completed their sentences but have yet to pay outstanding fines, restitution, and other fees. In an unsigned opinion, the conservative majority court declined to revisit a federal appeals court ruling permitting Florida to stop felons with outstanding court-imposed debt from registering to vote as the July 20th primary election registration deadline approaches. The dispute concerns a 2018 amendment to Florida's Constitution restoring voting rights to those with felony convictions who had completed all terms of their sentences. The state's legislature and highest court treat the amendment as requiring payment of all court-imposed costs before voting eligibility is restored, which sparked court challenges. In her dissent, Sonia Sotomayor said the court's inaction continues a trend of condoning disenfranchisement. And President Donald Trump announced Wednesday he's rolling back a major Nixon-era environmental law, the National Environmental Policy Act. Trump says stifles infrastructure projects. The act's supporters credit the law with keeping big construction projects from fouling up the environment and providing public input on major projects. The 1970 act changed environmental oversight in the United States, requiring federal agencies to consider if a project harms air, land, water, or wildlife, and giving the public the right to review and input. Trump spoke about his deregulation moves today at the White House. He says environmental laws stand in the way of business.
Our regulation cuts are also delivering massive savings on broadband internet services, and some home energy bills will be really historically cut. It's actually amazing. As well as historically low gasoline prices. Gasoline prices, you look today, I think it was $1.99. At the same time, we saved our oil companies. We're now the largest, since we've been here, the largest energy source in the world. Nobody's even close, so it's great. But we saved them. They had a hard time a number of months ago, and frankly, for a long time, but we've saved them. We're bringing back consumer choice in home appliances so that you can buy washers and dryers, shower heads and faucets. So shower heads, you take a shower, the water doesn't come out. You want to wash your hands, the water doesn't come out. So what do? You just stand there longer or you take a shower longer? Because my hair, I don't know about you, but it has to be perfect. Perfect. Dishwashers, you didn't have any water, so you, the people that do the dishes, you press it and it goes again, and you do it again and again. So you might as well give them the water because you'll end up using less water. So we made it so dishwashers now have a lot more water, and in many places, in most places of the country, water is not a problem. They don't know what to do with it. It's called rain. They don't have a problem. And old-fashioned incandescent light bulbs, I brought them back. I brought them back. They have two nice qualities. They're cheaper and they're better. They look better. They make you look so much better. That's important to all of us. They were mandated out, legislated out, and we brought them back, and they're selling like hotcakes. We stopped the egregious abuse of the Clean Water Act, which extreme activists have used to shut down construction projects all across our country.
Trump made yesterday's announcement in Georgia, a state at the center of the coronavirus pandemic, but he had nothing to say about the surge of cases and deaths in the state. Meanwhile, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp is prohibiting local governments from mandating that masks be worn in public places to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Kemp's order prevents local mask ordinances that are more restrictive than a statewide order. Kemp's move voids 15 local governments' mask rules. And in Florida, health officials say about 1 in 3 children in the state tested positive for COVID-19. About 54,000 children have been tested in the state. Experts fear the disease can cause potential lifelong damage in children. A Palm Beach County health official told Low County commissioners he reportedly showed x-rays revealing damage caused to human lungs, even for people without severe symptoms. Meanwhile, in a Quinnipiac University poll released Wednesday, 67% of registered voters surveyed don't trust information Trump provides on the coronavirus, while 30% do. 65% say they trust Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's leading infectious disease expert, while 26% distrust the information he provides. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi restated her demand today that White House uses federal powers to get more personal protective equipment into the hands of essential workers battling the new coronavirus surge. She compared Trump to a petulant man who can't ask directions.
The president has made so many bad executive decisions. We wish he would make a good executive decision and do that. Observing his behavior, I have concluded that he is like the man who refuses to ask for directions. All of the answers are there. The scientists have the answers. We know that testing, tracing, treating, distancing, masking, sanitation can stop the spread of this virus. And yet the president continues to go down the wrong path and refuses to ask for directions from scientists who know better than any of us. So again, we observed that it was 2 months. In that period of time, 2 million more people, 2 million more Americans have become infected, for a total of 3.5 million people infected. Since that time, 50,000 more people have died, for a total of over 137,000. Tens of millions of people are still out of work, and UI benefits expire soon. And today we marked the 17th straight weeks of more than 1 million people filing for UI benefits. And we still don't have the needed testing and PPE. And the president refuses to use the full power of the Defense Production Act needed for reopening. Reopening our schools, reopening our economy, and the rest.
And that's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Senate Republicans are expected to unveil their own roughly $1 trillion proposal for recovery and stimulus next week, a plan far narrower than the $3 trillion plus bill pushed through the House by Democrats 2 months ago. Among the key sticking points will be addressing the extra $600 in weekly unemployment benefits in the March CARES Act. House Democrats are also pushing for a boost in food aid, another round of stimulus checks to individuals, and nearly $1 trillion in state and local assistance. Another issue in any negotiations is the United States Postal Service. Since 2006, libertarian billionaires like Charles Koch have had privatizing the post office in their legislative sights. But polls show the letter carriers are the most popular government workers to most Americans. The executive director of the watchdog True North Research is Lisa Graves. She says delivering the mail is something the government does better than private industry.
There was a law that was passed in 2006 that really saddled the Postal Service with unprecedented debt to pay nearly 50 years into the future the amount that could be due for future retiree health benefits. No other company or agency in the U.S. or even the world has such an obligation. That was pushed by another Koch man, James Miller, with the help of Susan Collins of Maine and other legislators in 2006 under the guise of modernizing the Postal Service. It took billions of dollars that the Postal Service had in savings that could have been deployed to expand its operations or add greater efficiencies in its transportation services and put those into that fund. And then it hit the Postal Service with nearly $5 billion a year in debt payments. There was a brief period after 2009 when that was delayed a bit, when Democrats controlled Congress, but it came back into the Postal Service's balance sheet starting after 2016. And so now you have a situation where the Postal Service has substantial debts that are on its books. What it's asking Congress for is part of the COVID relief, just as many businesses have received. They've asked for $75 billion, but at least $25 billion to stave off bankruptcy this September.
Is that under debate right now in the current stimulus recovery package, the HEROES Act?
The HEROES Act would provide at least $25 billion to help the Postal Service avoid bankruptcy this fall, and it would hopefully help pave the way for the Postal Service securing some other loans to help it survive this coronavirus crisis. That was in the bill that passed the Congress, the United States House, and so now it's under consideration by the Senate, which is helmed by Mitch McConnell, who also backed this guy, James Miller, to be on the Postal Service Board of Governors, the guy who was the Postal Service privatization king.
Is there a possibility of the Postal Service being defunded?
Unless there is tremendous pressure by citizens across the country in big cities and small towns to call every legislator, call them repeatedly to demand that the Postal Service get some relief, and also, quite frankly, to demand that this 2006 law be repealed. We are at risk of losing this vital public institution to predatory Wall Street vultures.
Who would replace the Postal Service?
I'm sure that there are some private companies that would be eager to take a huge chunk of revenues out of basically the assets and the services that the Postal Service provides. There are certainly courier services as well as companies like Federal Express or UPS that might try to take part of that business, although it's notable that for some of those companies, they themselves rely on the Postal Service because it's not sufficiently profitable for them to deliver in some of these remote locations where Americans live and rely on the Postal Service.
Even within New York City, there's certain buildings that don't get broadband, that don't get Fios, that don't get different things because they're poor buildings and it costs too much to wire them. And they sit there like a sore thumb surrounded by high rises that are built with this stuff already built in.
The market does not know best. The market doesn't do best for all people. This sort of mythology of Charles Koch's and his Koch and his allies that the free market somehow will make the best choices is just proven wrong time and time again. We need government services. We need public institutions to serve all Americans, even if it's not the most profitable business, because having a postal service that reaches all of us efficiently is something that only the government can do and only the government will do, because the private sector has routinely demonstrated that it won't serve certain communities, it won't serve certain neighborhoods unless it can profit enough from doing so. Now we have a person at the helm of the Postal Service, the Postmaster General, who was a pick of Donald Trump. This Lou DeJoy character, who's a big Republican fundraiser, who's also trying to privatize the Postal Service and weaken it. I actually think the Board of Governors, the Postal Service that approved him, ought to be hounded out of office for approving someone who should certainly not be entrusted with the responsibility to care for this public institution and ensure that it actually is doing the work of the American people versus advancing the privatization agenda that Trump has also embraced.
Lisa Graves is the executive director of True North Research. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. 75 years ago today, the first atomic bomb was detonated in a remote New Mexico mountain valley known as La Jornada de Muertos, the Journey of Death. It was the result of the biggest and most secret project ever undertaken by the United States in wartime. Uranium from Katanga in the Congo was shipped through a net of German U-boats to a warehouse in Staten Island, and then on to a vast network of factories and workshops, ending in some cases in Hanford, Washington, a vast, top-secret, incredibly polluting industrial operation. Tons of uranium was turned into 9 gallons of plutonium, taken by courier on a passenger train to Los Alamos, New Mexico, fashioned into a bomb, and trucked to the remote site near the small town of Alamogordo. The wife of one of the scientists who would be there, Elsie McMillan, described her feelings the night before.
Things were moving fast now. There soon would be a test near Alamogordo at White Sands, the very place we had visited with carefree abandon a few years ago. I asked Ed in all innocence what would happen. It seemed an easy question with a simple answer. Knowing that it was an atomic bomb they were testing should have made me more aware of what would be involved. It was difficult for Ed to tell me. He finally answered, there will be about 50 of us present, key workers. We ourselves are not absolutely certain what will happen. In spite of calculations, we are going into the unknown. We know that there are 3 possibilities. 1, that we will all be blown to bits if it is more powerful than we expect. If this happens, you and the world will be immediately told. 2, it may be a complete dud. If this happens, you will also be told. Third, it may, as we hope, be a success. We pray without loss of any lives. In this case, there will be a broadcast to the world with a plausible explanation for the noise and the tremendous flash of light which will appear in the sky. With our alarm set for 2:30 a.m., Ed would leave at 3:15. We did not want to allow much time. We did not want to say goodbye.
Elsie McMillan, the wife of atomic scientist Edward McMillan. The civilian head of the project was physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, a New Yorker with communist connections. He was considered the most brilliant scientist of his time. He described his feelings as the huge mushroom cloud illuminated the valley floor.
The world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
Scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer. Within a few years, the Soviet Union exploded their first atomic bomb. In the next decade, the orders of magnitude larger hydrogen bomb was developed by both countries. In the arms race that lasted until 1992, enough bombs were built to destroy life on Earth, according to many scientists. Now the bomb has proliferated to many countries and others are in development. Last week, a nuclear production site in Iran was exploded under mysterious circumstances. A research fellow in non-proliferation studies at the International Institute for Strategic Studies is Dr. Masa Rui.
The building that the explosion happened at is a workshop for the assembly of more advanced centrifuges, and it's part of the larger facility that's called the Natanz facility. It's a compound and has a combination of underground and overground workshops and buildings, and it's really the heart of Iran's sort of nuclear program. It's where most of their enrichment and research and development happens.
Was this workshop where the explosion happened important to Iran's nuclear capability?
The advanced centrifuges are really critical for Iran in so many different ways.
For our listeners who might not know this, why is a centrifuge important?
The centrifuges will enrich uranium, and as far as I think the American audience will be concerned, the importance of it is that this is how the U.S. and other countries calculate the time in which Iran needs to have enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. The number of centrifuges, the type of the centrifuges, and a lot of different factors come into calculating a measure, then ends up being translated by experts into this is how far Iran is from having enough material and the capability to build a nuclear weapon.
Did this attack, or if that's what it is, actually make it more difficult for Iran to achieve its nuclear weapon? Did it have an effect on that?
The Iranian government estimate is a few months, but really the expert estimate is between 1 or 2 years. It did have a setback impact on the program in general, but again, it comes at a cost and consequences which will potentially drive Iranian decision-making into accelerating the program even further and expanding on it, and not only to make up for the setback, but also to sort of be less transparent in the future about their activities, be less cooperative with the IAEA about the inspections. It is important to note that Natanz is a site that is an official site under IAEA inspections. And so if this was a sabotage attack, it will have serious consequences on the debate in Iran on whether, and already there is a dispute between IAEA and Iran over inspections, and I'm afraid these kinds of attacks would only make Iran less likely to resolve such disputes.
From how you describe this, is this just a children's game using deadly weapons as toys? They put greater centrifuges, whoever blows them up, and then they get mad and make twice as many centrifuges, and this does nothing to stop the proliferation problem.
You actually put it really well. I mean, it's not just this one particular attack. There has been a lot of debate for years now over Iran's nuclear program and what's the best way to deal with it. And one of the arguments that experts have made over the years is that even if you attack their nuclear facilities, it will actually make them more determined to build a nuclear bomb. So even if they have not made a political decision now to go ahead and build a bomb, if we attack their facilities, this will definitely trigger that decision because they will believe this will buy them immunity, right? They had nuclear weapons. None of these attacks, in the view of the hardliners in Tehran, none of this would have happened if they already had a weapon or if there were not as much cooperation and inspections with the IAEA. What is really important is to think about what is really the long-term goal. And if the long-term goal is to prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon, it is important to keep that in perspective and not sacrifice it for more short-term goals. And the only effort that seemed to be, you know, in the right direction to achieve that goal is actually diplomacy. Look at the JCPOA and compare it to attacks like this. JCPOA set Iran's nuclear program back and sort of rolled it back in some areas for 8 years, in some areas for 10 and for 15 years. So compare that with a small setback that could actually trigger an acceleration of the program and potentially a political decision to cross a threshold in the future.
This is an act of war, blowing up somebody's facilities. The U.S. wouldn't put up with it if somebody did that to us. I mean, Iran doesn't have the facilities to strike back, but it might. You know, they've threatened many times to attack ships in the Gulf. This might hasten a non-nuclear confrontation.
There will be a response. It's just a matter of when and how. They might not respond immediately. These kinds of attacks and this kind of escalation, it always comes with a risk. There is a possibility of miscalculation. There is miscommunication. Any of these tit for tats could end up sort of triggering a much more broader and a direct conflict between Iran and the U.S.
Dr. Masaroui is a research fellow in nonproliferation studies at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Closer to home, Mayor Bill de Blasio, anxious to reopen schools in September, announced a plan for childcare for 100,000 young people from elementary through high school.
We've been trying to find every way to create new childcare and to build it from scratch, honestly, because we're having to create something that didn't exist before on this scale to accommodate a new need and a new reality. We initially said, how much could we do? And we thought maybe we could do 50,000 childcare seats. And then we realized with a blended format that actually turns into 100,000 families that can be served. We're going to use every conceivable space, community centers, libraries, cultural organizations, whatever we can find in communities. We're going to have one approach for early childhood, another approach for K to 8. And the goal will be to start by serving 100,000 kids and giving those families, those parents, that balance in their life, that relief, that support. But then we aim to go farther. Now we've got a little under 2 months until school begins. We've got a lot to do, and nothing like this has ever been attempted on this time frame. But we're going to find a way to do this and hopefully much more.
And reopening of schools is far from a done deal. With coronavirus cases surging around the country, New York teachers and parents are rightly worried about the outcome. Meanwhile, on Monday, New York City enters phase 4 of reopening, with most indoor activities still on hold. And finally, a march by religious people in support of a peaceful resolution of racial conflict was apparently hijacked by a march of police supporters. The march across the Brooklyn Bridge to City Hall was initially conceived by a coalition of black clergy leaders as a community-focused Christian unity event. But after the Sergeants Benevolent Association distributed a separate flyer for the event describing it as a rally to support law enforcement as well as clergy, hundreds of current and former NYPD officers showed up sporting matching blue T-shirts, waving thin blue line flags, and holding signs in support of police funding. They clashed with Black Lives Matter protesters who linked arms across the walkway over the bridge.
You will be placed under arrest on the charge of disorderly conduct. If you do not cooperate and accompany the arresting officer to the prisoner transport vehicle, or if you resist arrest, you may be charged with additional crimes. Since you have refused to leave the roadway, you will be placed under arrest on the charge of disorderly conduct.
According to The Gothamist, Sergeant Arthur Smarsh, himself an SBA board member and participant in the march across the Brooklyn Bridge, directed the NYPD to make the arrests. Then a man in purple shirt struck three officers with a cane, causing bloody injuries. Chief of Department Terrence Monahan reportedly suffered a finger sprain during the arrest operation. SBA President Ed Mullins apparently organized the march and approved leaflets implying the Christian group was affiliated with the Blue Lives Matter group. Today, Mayor de Blasio had this to say.
The SBA has only practiced division. They foment hatred. They don't try and help us move forward. I have been fighting with them for years, and they have been fighting with our police leadership for years. They attack Jimmy O'Neill viciously. They've attacked Dermot Shea. They don't try to create anything good. They only try and tear down, which is why I have no respect for the leadership of the SBA.
And that's Mayor de Blasio. And that's some of the news for Thursday, July 16, 2020. The news was produced Linda Perry and engineered with Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo.